Get in on all the sports action and your chance to win up to 100 times your cash with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 long seasons of exile in the National League. Dedicated staff and passionate supporters celebrate the city's return to glory, the big time, all while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in that higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One's promised land? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
The UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Europa Conference League all return this week. And today, the Champions League group stage kicks off exclusively on Paramount+. Soccer's biggest stars face off with dreams of advancing to the knockout rounds. Fireworks are guaranteed with blockbuster matchups between the world's most storied clubs. Every single game for all three competitions, all available live and on demand, exclusively at Paramount+. And new subscribers, you can get a 7-day free trial now by going to paramountplus.com/MIB.
There's so much brilliant football as we come down to the stretch of the Premier League season. But if you're a Premier League neutral who wants a little bit of that title race excitement, check out Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app, where you can get in on the action and win up to 100 times your cash. Prize Picks is the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across our nation, including California, Texas, and Georgia. You just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. You can also mix and match players from several leagues across the globe, as well as other sports like basketball and hockey. That's right, Prize Picks. Essentially a utopia where polysport action can live and breathe. I'm talking Washington Caps, Everton, and Chicago Bulls action all at once in the face. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. That's promo code MIB. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. This episode is sponsored by Audible, the home of storytelling. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalogue. Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. I'm currently listening to The Secret Hours by Mick Herron. That's the standalone prequel to the majestic Slow Horses television series. I can't stop listening. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500. That's audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network, Suboptimal Radio.
What I'm going to say is, I said it before, Champions League is that's my favourite competition.
This is Rog, and you are listening to European Nights, presented by Paramount Plus, and it's a big week for this show. All of our beloved competitions are returning to our loving arms, possibly have even already returned by the time you're listening to this, and alongside my grating voice is a much more soothing one. It is, of course, the multi-talented Rory Smith, chief soccer correspondent for your New York Times. Rory, how are we doing?
I'm all right, how are you?
You do not sound like a man who has just unleashed, Ken Follett style, an incredible best-selling tome into this world. Of course, I should add, Rory is now the author of the brilliant new book, Expected Goals, the story of how data conquered football and changed the game forever. Buy your copy now, dear listeners. I'll be honest, I've only had the chance to get halfway through, but I assume, Rory, it ends with you forecasting Everton's 2024 Premier League title.
That is the natural conclusion to any book. In fact, that is, I think, how all Ken Follett books end as well, isn't it? With a prediction about Everton's forthcoming glory.
Rory's deep on the sci-fi volumes.
No, it's the story of what I think has been a really important change in the way that we think and talk about football and the way that football thinks and talks about itself. That there's lots of stories in there about Tottenham, about Arsenal, about Liverpool, about Brentford and Brighton. It has been, I have to say, led mainly by English clubs. That is where the data revolution happened first and fastest. But you've got Ajax that I think are doing some really interesting stuff. The German teams catching up. Germany's always had quite a kind of progressive attitude towards data. There's teams in the Champions League who will be preparing for games using data, who'll be scouting players using data, who will be doing interesting things in the way they play using data. And then there's Manchester United. Although they're not in the Champions League, of course. So it's something that I think is important to understand how it's happened, where it's come from, to understand the game that we see in front of us.
Again, dear listeners, that book is called Expected Goals, the story of how data conquered football, changed the game forever. If you, like me, revere Billy Beane, it is the book for you. But I do always worry for the football journalists in my life when transfer deadline day is approaching. I think I need to take a few days in a floating sensory deprivation tank to recover from that experience. Do you ever get the itch to really hit that beat for info, like Rory Smith up there with Fabrizio Romano and David Ornstein? Or is that world of breaking transfer exclusives not really your speed?
There's a thrill about it. I have done deadline days, not to the level that Fabrizio and David do it. I've never been that effective, that efficient, and that, to be honest, fearsome. In terms of transfer stuff, but there's a real thrill to reporting on a transfer deadline day when you you're competing with everybody to get the stories first. You know that stuff's happening. You feel in your water that there might be a big exclusive somewhere if only you make the right call or send the right message. I don't particularly have to do it for the New York Times. It's not something we try and compete with, mainly because the British papers, the British TV stations, The Athletic, they've all got dozens of reporters and it'd just be me and Tarek. And I think that's a lot to ask of us, to be honest. But if there's a big one, you know, we try and keep across it. And obviously, you kind of have to be aware of what's going on, partly because if something massive happens, you need to have an immediate opinion on whether you think it's good or bad. But also because as a fan, and I know we all sneer at transfer deadline day and the ridiculousness of it and the yellow tickers and the ties and all that business, but it is exciting. There's no denying it. It's genuinely exciting knowing which player your team might sign on loan for 6 months. That is the most exciting feeling football can give you, I think.
When you say you and Tarek Panja are all over it for the New York Times, I bet you Ralph Nader, who I know now listens to this podcast with just a fervent, obsessive sense of commitment that even he can't believe. I will say I did love your piece in the Times where you called the Premier League spending spree of $2.3 billion a record by some distance, quote, a wild and unrestrained festival of consumption. Premier League is now hollowing out the Spanish, German, Italian leagues as it once did the Belgian, Dutch and Brazilian. It's a bit dark.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You're kind of torn because, you know, we both support teams in England and you want your team to sign players and you want your team to have the best players available. And you understand why clubs want to spend money and you can't blame the Premier League clubs, I guess, for spending money that they have in most cases earned through being in the Premier League, effectively, it all comes from TV money. And it is obviously nothing new. The Premier League's done that for years. But the scale of it this summer, I did find slightly disconcerting. Not just the figures involved, but the lack of thought almost in the way it was being spent. And there was a story that came out, I think Fabrizio did it, after the transfer window had closed, that Chelsea had offered Southampton £50 million, so $65 million, I guess, for Romeo Lavia. And Romeo Lavia has played for Southampton about three times, because he signed from Man City earlier in the summer. And he's done well, but quite how Chelsea can justify thinking, okay, we're going to, 3 months later, we're going to add an extra £35 million onto that and bring him in straight away. I find it extraordinary. It doesn't strike me that that is money being spent with any great logic or coherence or any plan. And I'd also question quite what the meaning of it is. If their approach is just to buy the best players, whoever they can think of, and hope to win, does that mean as much as if you've kind of maybe put a team together quite smartly, quite adroitly over the course of a couple of years? I feel like that's maybe something that has a greater significance. Something, it's a story that's easier to fall in love with, and I think that's really important.
Oh, love. I remember love, Rory Smith. We've got a packed show for you today, listeners, beginning with some UEFA drama that honestly makes Succession look lame. We'll then dive into, well, God, a mass of great Italian tunes, some Europa League goodiness, and more magical stories. Remember, all the teams we talk about today will compete live and on demand exclusively on Paramount Plus. New subscribers can get a 7-day free trial now by going to paramountplus.com/MIB. That's paramountplus.com/MIB. But now to the football. PSG ultras serenading Neymar on the day of his unveiling there. Somehow, that was already 5 years ago. And it feels wrong to say that those were simpler times, but it does kind of feel that way. And today, we're starting with a team whose budgetary resources are outstripped only by their lusty ambition. Paris Saint-Germain, Messi's boys, kicking off proceedings in the Champions League with a headline match of the week, hosting Weston McKennie's Juventus at the Parc des Princes. If you missed it, get the highlights exclusively on Paramount Plus. PSG, as we discussed last week, have spent the summer doing some future-proofing, but news broke last Thursday that PSG were subject to the heaviest fine in Europe in UEFA's latest round of financial fair play sanctions after their investigations over the previous 5 years. PSG among 8 teams fined for breaching the wage and transfer to earnings ratio. For all you accountants listening, PSG's fine is the heaviest at €65 million, only 10 of which require mandatory payment directly or via revenue earned through UEFA competitions. The other 55 milli, depending on compliance with future FFP targets over the coming 3 years. Look, it's all bloody confusing, but it boils down to this. For a club as wealthy as PSG, it results to little more than a slap on the wrist, particularly given, as your colleague at the New York Times, Tariq Panja, pointed out, recurring financial fair play violations were previously met with a threat of expulsion, a big stick punishment that's at the very least not explicitly laid out in their latest ruling. Rory, what is the signal being sent with this latest round of slap-on-the-wrist sanctions?
I guess on one level, you know, if PSG do have to pay €65 million, that's quite a lot of money even to PSG. I think the chances that they will have to pay €65 million are pretty slim. And €10 million to PSG is, it's not even a backup right back, is it? It's a transfer tax. It's a tip. They've had to tip UEFA a little bit for the right to spend all of the money they have. In one sense, it is a confirmation, I guess, that PSG have broken the break-even requirements, that they have not complied with the rules. The chances that they'll care are pretty much zero, I think. I don't think there's any reputational damage even from being fined. And I'm sure that as FFP kind of changes and morphs into something different, we're not quite sure what shape it's going to take, that those targets they have to meet will suddenly become quite a lot more realistic. I think it's almost this is confirmation that whatever the attempts behind FFP, whatever you think about them, whether you think that European football needs some sort of kind of financial regulation, that era is done.
And that kind of oversight is most certainly not coming from UEFA, which brings us to the undercurrent of this story regarding PSG's president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, a gent who wears, let's just say, many hats. He transitioned into the role of chairman of the European Club Association, an independent body composed of and representing the clubs in Europe, essentially the club's union, their muscle. When interfacing with UEFA, it was founded with the mission of creating a more democratic, club-forward governance model. And the ECA was greatly shaken up by the turmoil, the tumult, the general awfulness of the European Super League. Its chairman at the time, Juventus's Andrea Agnelli, who you will remember was a man who spearheaded the push to secede. He was one of the great brains, and I use the word great brains lightly, behind the Super League project. And I relived this whole story through a wonderful piece by you, Rory, and the aforementioned Tarek Panja, How the Super League Fell Apart. Seek it out, listeners. Google it, because the drama that unfolds is really prime time. Agnelli betraying close personal friend, godfather to his own children, and UEFA president Alexander Seferin, like Avon and Stringer in The Wire. "We ain't got a dream no more, man," I'm sure he whispered to him in Italian. What we couldn't quite know at the time was how PSG had so expertly manoeuvred themselves through all of this. They hedged their bets on UEFA, turned down the Super League, provided Seferin insider information on his own plans, and when Agnelli was invited to leave his post with the European Club Association, who would step in to become chairman? Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who also ended up on the executive committee of UEFA at the same time. Rory, can you talk about this enigmatic one-time Qatari tennis pro turned global footballing kingmaker? He's essentially on the board of bloody everything. And is it all too simplistic to say this new responsibility for the PSG president was a direct reward for his efforts to ultimately destabilise the Super League?
I suppose you probably can't say that with absolute conviction, but the timing is pretty interesting. So I think that the best way of thinking of Al-Khelaifi is he essentially wears four hats, doesn't he? So he's president of PSG, that's fine. Because he's the kind of representative of QSI, another acronym, that which is Qatari Sports Investment. He's also president of the ECA. Now, that kind of makes sense because the ECA is a body that exists for the clubs, to represent the clubs. Whether it does that or not is a different matter. Part of the problem there may well be that the most powerful voices in the ECA are the big clubs. There's not very many big clubs. There's quite a lot of medium-sized clubs, or clubs that, you know, in context look medium-sized. Big question mark over whether the ECA actually represents their interests at all, which is what it's meant to do. But okay, fine. President of PSG, it's as well him being president of the ECA as the president of Bayern Munich or Barcelona or whoever. Fine, if you're going to have an elite club leading that organisation, no problem with it being PSG. Sits on the board at UEFA. Kingmaker at UEFA, as you say, kind of Alexander Seferin's new confidant and trusted lieutenant. again, like, clubs have a right to be represented at UEFA. It's important that they are. I don't know how I feel about the president of the ECA also being kind of the most potent voice at UEFA. It feels like you're not getting what might be referred to as a multiplicity of voices there. That feels like one guy's view is getting an awful lot of air in other people's opinions, maybe a little bit less. But there's a fourth hat, and the fourth hat is that Nasser Al-Khelaifi is also effectively in charge of beIN Sports, which is a broadcaster based out of Qatar, and is a major rights holder for lots and lots of leagues. It's a really important rights holder in terms of football, not least for UEFA, as well as the French league for a long time. And it's at that point that you think, hang on, that's an awful lot of influence and power and interconnectedness for one person to deal with. I don't know how Nasser remembers which hat he's wearing when his phone rings. How does he know if someone's trying to talk to Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the president of the ECA? Or
I think Rory, you solve that problem with burner phones.
The burner phones are, as always, as we've said previously, Rog, that's the solution to everything, burner phones.
I know, so I've been told.
You don't want to accuse Nasser of doing anything wrong. What he's done is perfectly legal. You know, it's viable within the statutes of all those organisations. There's no crime being committed by what he's doing. But it's an awful lot of, power for one person. And it's also, I would say, pretty clear that some of those roles intersect in less than ideal ways with others. So the ECA and UEFA are joint venture partners. They help to sell the rights to European competitions. Because obviously the UEFA organises the competitions, the ECA is theoretically the representative of the clubs that are in them. So the fact that there's such a close union there, how do you know that the best interests of both organisations are being represented fairly when it's just one guy? Equally, being a really important business partner in the sense that they are buying rights off UEFA and off UEFA competitions. So how does that one work? That seems a bit strange. And I know that Miguel Maduro, Tarek Panja, my colleague, did a piece on this over the summer. And Miguel Maduro, who's a former sort of bigwig at FIFA, his view is that there is a very clear conflict of interest here and that there are statutes that exist for conflicts of interest, certainly UEFA, and that it's very strange to have it and then not use it. The fact that it exists and hasn't been used is probably testament to how influential Nasser is at this point in European football. You can make a case that he is the most powerful man possibly in all of football because he wears those four hats.
God, Rory, on the heels of this FFP fine of somewhere between 10 and 65 million measly euros in PSG's perspective in recompense for the continent's biggest wage bill at some canter, in your opinion, what threat does PSG's increasingly evident ties with UEFA pose to any semblance of healthy competition? Or does football now run completely like that old New York business adage, if there's no conflict, there's no interest?
It should be pointed out this isn't just PSG, that this existed before with, for example, Andrea Agnelli. It was just as much of a problem then, although Agnelli didn't run a TV station, admittedly. The problem is that the voices of the big clubs have undue weight, both at UEFA and at the ECA, and they are a minority. They represent a tiny proportion of the number of clubs. And in actual fact, they represent a tiny proportion of the number of fans. You know, it might seem like Legia Warsaw and Panathinaikos don't have a lot of fans, but if you add all of those dozens, hundreds of clubs together, they represent quite a lot of people's interests. And it feels like those voices have been frozen out completely, and they've been frozen out in exchange for the accumulation of power and influence by a very small cabal of teams. The fact that it's PSG now, whereas it was previously Juventus and Bayern Munich and possibly Real Madrid and Barcelona, it's not necessarily worse, but it's definitely not better. And I think that is something that football has to be really conscious of, that we have seen a drift where the sport seems to be constructed exclusively for the benefit of the few rather than for the health of the many, to co-opt an old British political slogan. It works pretty nicely for PSG and it works pretty nicely for the big clubs. Whether it works well for everybody else, I think, is very much open to question.
Is there a possibility of any kind of check and balance appearing at the boardroom level of football, or have you completely given up on that? I mean, do you have any notion of what that could look like?
I think it's a real shame. It would have to come from UEFA and possibly FIFA. And there are ways, to me, of redressing the balance a little bit if you're UEFA. One of the things that I find most disappointing about Alexander Seferin, the UEFA president, who I quite like, Seferin's a very sort of compelling, quite charismatic man. He came to power basically by saying to the 40 nations in Europe who get nothing from UEFA, for whom the game has basically been taken away by the big countries, saying, "I will represent your interests." And he's done the opposite. And that, I think, is really disappointing. There is a possibility that UEFA could change with enough dynamism and energy and will. The problem is that never seems to appear, because once you get into power at UEFA, there's suddenly a lot of people around you who wield an awful lot of influence, who are in your ear making their cases heard, and their voices are louder than everybody else's.
God, the one way to be sure that an incoming football bureaucrat is going to do nothing for the little guys is when he campaigns on a platform of saying, "I'm here for the little guys." How those dominoes fall remains to be seen. One thing's for sure, this Tuesday, when Juventus arrived in Paris, Nasser Al-Khelaifi and Andrea Agnelli will not have ultimately enjoyed a cosy meal at Le Petit Cambodge that you and I would if we were together, Rory. Though maybe they'll patch things up and have a scoop of gelato at Grom for the return fixture when PSG are in Turin. You know, stranger things have happened. Worry not, listeners. We're briefly abandoning the semantics, getting back into the actual football. It's why we're here, after all. It's what bonds us. After a quick break. Are you ready for some football?
Paramount Plus. This is original series, like Star Trek Lower Decks and Mike Judge's Beavis and Butthead.
This is gonna be cool.
Live sports, like the NFL on CBS.
What a touchdown!
Family favorites, like Big Nate and Camp Coral, SpongeBob's Under Years. And exclusive movies, like Honor Society and Secret Headquarters.
Your dad's a superhero.
This is a mountain of entertainment. Paramount Plus. Stream now.
It's Rog here to tell you about a product that I simply adore. It's been a long time staple in the Bennett refrigerator, Stoke Cold Brew Coffee. Always bold, always smooth. Yes, that is the very same Stoke as in the mighty Wrexham Fortress, known as the Stoke Kairas or the Stoke Racecourse, Wrexham AFC's home. They support it. They support football, which is just one great reason to love this coffee. It is my go-to enjoy during the football calendar, essentially the opposite of Everton. And you can check out their full lineup of 48 ounce cold brew products, something for everybody, from light to dark roast to seasonal favorites, in a refrigerated multi-serve format. I tell you this as someone whose blood type is now officially Stoke Espresso Blend. Have the coffee house experience in the comfort of your own home and do it now. Stoke Cold Brew Coffee, and be sure to follow Wrexham AFC. Big love to all at Stoke. Courage.
È la data che tengo a memoria. AC Milan uguale vittoria. In Europa si è fatta la storia. Milanisti nel cuore. Sono 11 in campo e milioni là fuori. Rossoneri guerrieri. Anche all'estero sentono i cori. È una realtà partita da qua. La città della Madonna.
That was hashtag Rossoneri by Milanese artist, rapper Emis Killer and percussionist Santonino. An appropriately self-aggrandizing tune for one of Europe's truly great historic teams. AC Milan equals victory. In Europe, we made history. So much iconic imagery abounds around AC Milan. The black and red striped shirts, the birth, the nickname Rossoneri, red to symbolise the passion of the team and the fans, and the odd flare or two that are known to erupt around the games. Black to symbolise the fear their opponents experience since they were founded in 1899. Yes, jersey designers came up with this kind of crap even back in the 19th century, and throughout the 20th century, this team was constantly embroiled in a dogfight with Juventus and Inter for Serie A supremacy. They are now primarily known around the world, yeah, as Serginio Dest's new mob. But back in the 1980s, the club plunged into financial crisis. It was future Italian Prime Minister and sunbed addict Silvio Berlusconi who stepped away from bronzing his down belows at the tanning salon to bail the club out in 1986. Berlusconi announced his arrival modestly by helicoptering himself and the AC Milan team into their landmark Arena Civica with Richard Wagner's Flight of the Valkyries blasting over the chopper loudspeakers. Subtle-like, and through the turn of the century, AC Milan then emerged as the stuff of Pinterest football mood board legend Paolo Maldini and his one gold chain holding down the back line, while Ruud Gullit, Frank Rijkaard and Marco van Basten's attacking ingenuity made the Rossoneri dream, retaining consecutive Champions League titles in 1989 and 1990. Rory, last week you alluded to just how absurd it feels to point to AC Milan as a rank outsider for Champions League contention. But can you elaborate on how this club really built their legend upon iconic European nights?
AC Milan are European royalty, and I think that has been forgotten a little bit in the last 10 years, say, because of the rise of the Premier League, the dominance of Real Madrid, the glamour of Barcelona. AC Milan are historically not far off Real Madrid and Bayern Munich. They are the same level. They are, I think they still in some ways claim to be kind of the second most popular team in China. I don't quite know how they worked out they were the second most popular team in China. It's also a weird...
Yeah, if you say something, it becomes true in football.
That's true,
it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird boast. Like, if you don't spin it, just say you're the biggest in China and see what happens. No one can disprove it. Don't be like, oh yeah, do you know what? We're actually the fourth biggest team in Shanghai. And a lot of that can be traced back to that period in the first flush of Berlusconi, in which Milan not only lifted two European Cups in 1989 and 1990, they were, until Real Madrid, the last team to retain the European Cup. They then, in 1994, put together probably the most devastating performance in a European final that any team has ever managed.
La finale più attesa fra le due squadre pronosticate alla vigilia, il Milan e il Barcellona. Milan in completa...
That game is my favourite European final, I think, because you have on one side Johan Cruyff's dream team at Barcelona, Romario, Stoichkov, Hadji, Pep Guardiola, a young Pep Guardiola, all these incredible players, and you have Milan of Marcel Desailly, Dragan Stojkovic, Ruud Gullit, Maldini, Baresi, Costa Curta, Tassotti, all these famous names.
Just suave and swagger.
That Milan team were actually quite exciting to watch. And I think that's forgotten because we sort of think of Italian football as being defensive, particularly in its 1990s heyday. But that Milan team were beautiful to watch, and not just because of Paolo Maldini. They were incredibly talented and gifted and sweeping forward. Stojkovic was as good a playmaker as you'll see. They had a real expansive adventurous style to them. I'm not sure there's ever been a European final, Champions League final, between two teams who are of absolutely equal weight. I'm trying to think of like a boxing analogy, but it was kind of... I'm going to betray myself a little bit here and say Ric Flair against Hulk Hogan. That's what this is. And you're expecting this incredibly kind of vibrant game, but really tightly poised game, a game with fine margins. And Milan beat them 4-0. Finished off with Marcel Desailly scoring a chip.
Albertini, Desailly, solo, goal, e sono quattro.
The most comprehensive swatting aside of a major team in history. This wasn't kind of, you know, a big superpower beating an underdog. It wasn't a mismatch. It was two superb teams, and Milan were just a level above everybody. And I think at that point, the mid-1990s, Milan were going through Serie A unbeaten. They were winning European Cups for fun. They were the biggest team in the world. They were the height of glamour, the height of glitz, the height of sophistication. And in a lot of ways, they were the first truly modern football team. And their brand was glamour. Their brand was Berlusconi. Their brand was being the best. And I think that made Milan something that everybody else looked at and tried to follow. And in that sense, you can make a case that Milan invented modern football to the extent that in the museum at Milan's headquarters in Milan, there is I think probably not full-scale replica, but pretty big replica of the helicopter that Berlusconi used. I think the first day that he landed at the training ground, he came by helicopter, and there is a model of that helicopter in pride of place in Milan's museum.
God, I am as excited by that news as I was when I found out that the ABBA Museum in Stockholm has the helicopter from the front cover of ABBA Arrival amongst its many, many fine assets. Go to both museums, dear listeners, revel in all of the great helicopters of Europe. But after winning the Scudetto in 2010-11, the decade to a period of steady decline for Milan as Juventus' vice grip on the league tightened. And in 2016, a little-known Chinese businessman named Yong Hong Lee stepped up to buy the club, probably because it was the second biggest team in China. He took a $300 million loan out from American investment firm Elliott Investment Management. You may remember them from the period in which they owned Argentina. Google it, guys. And within 2 years, Lee defaulted on loan payments and AC Milan fell into the hands of Elliott. What followed was an involved process, reducing the club's wage bill and the age profile to balance the severe debt, cutting costs and improving listing performances. Really football alchemy. But under Elliott's oversight, they brought in Ivan Gazidis to run the club, ex of Arsenal,
Milan began to improve year on year, sixth in 2020, second in 2021, and entering last season, really, AC Milan had become a real joy to watch once more. A dynamic defence anchored by Europe's most underrated goalkeeper, Mike Maignan. A wonderful midfield balance. The electric and unpredictable Rafael Leao feeding Serie A Shaq and Kobe, Giroud and Ibra. A real team emerging under journeyman Italian coach Stefano Pioli, with its wage bill slashed, one of the younger sides in the league too, and a firmly mid-table net spend was defied as AC Milan won the Scudetto last year, their first in 11 aching long years. And Rory, may sound antithetical to the core of the club, given the gilded history we discussed about helicopters and triumph just minutes ago, but this has got to be one of the most improbable Serie A titles in many years, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there was, I think, the scenes in Milan where you had tens of thousands of people on the streets to celebrate showed just how much it meant for a club that was so used to winning titles. The fact they'd been for more than a decade without one, I think, was a genuine ache. The end of that wait led to this sort of explosion of absolute delirium amongst what is probably still the second best supported club, not only in China, but in Italy. Does Juventus atop? I don't know where Juventus rank in China, but not second. I think there's a really interesting kind of dynamic to Milan's recent history, because under Berlusconi, they did become this uber modern club, this pioneering club. You know, they became famous for Milan Lab, which was their medical facility, where they seemed to be able to get, you know, extra 3, 4, 5 years out of players when others couldn't. You know, they were this incredibly advanced team in a lot of ways. And over, I guess, the course of the first decade of this century, they lost their way completely. They seemed to be run by a gerontocracy off the pitch. They had an aging team on it. They still won the Champions League in 2007 on one of your favourite evenings as a football fan, Rog.
Definitely, yeah. Top there last year, yeah.
They were still a force. They made the final in 2005 as well. So they were still kind of an important team in the early to mid 2000s, but they were becoming an old side. You know, a lot of their players were in their 30s, the balance was wrong. They weren't looking to the future. And it took them a long time to recover from that. And it only really happened because they got themselves into a position where the club might have disappeared completely. Yonghon Lee was not a suitable owner for AC Milan. He remains a bit of a mystery, quite how he got the financing together to do it, quite where he came from. That, I think, is a story that has yet to be told in full. And then Elliot stepped in, and in a sense, that was disastrous, because that was effectively the club being handed over to its creditors. But Elliot have instituted a really intelligent approach. And whether they wanted to be in charge of AC Milan or not, I don't know. But they found themselves with this asset in possession, and they did what an activist investor does, and that is try and make it more valuable.
I think the honest truth of Elliot is they are invested in so many important assets in Italy. Once they did inherit AC Milan, they knew, just for their own reputation, at the very least, they had to make sure they did intelligent things with the club and they didn't treat it just like an empty vessel. But clearly, Rory, I was not the only American admiring AC Milan from across the Atlantic, because in June, a deal was struck, completed just last week, seeing American equity group Redbird Capital Partners. They acquired AC Milan for $1.2 billion, backed by investment from the New York Yankees commercial arm, Yankee Global Enterprises, and Main Street Advisors. Isn't it great in football just how many equity groups' names we now know the name? Redbird Capital Partners, Main Street Advisors, a Los Angeles investment advisory group that works with, amongst others, Drake, friend of this show, and the man Zlatan Ibrahimovic once told to stick to sports, LeBron James, who has now himself become the LeBron James of Italian soccer. Redbird, not new to the football world. They also took over French League Two's Toulouse in 2020, and following a data-driven approach that you would enjoy, Rory.
Very much so.
Propelled the club back to Ligue 1 at the end of last season. Rui, what does this takeover signal to you, both at the practical level of AC Milan's ability to continue on their upward trajectory without losing key players, and in a broader sense about the status quo of ownership across European football?
Well, I think what Redbird will do with Milan is basically what Elliot have been doing, but more. There will be a really sort of intense focus on data. They'll look for undervalued markets. They will look to sign players so that they can basically sell them to England. That will be their plan. And if not to England, then to PSG or Bayern Munich or Real Madrid or Barcelona. Rafael Leao will be the next one off that production list. After that, it will be Fikayo Tomori, a talented English defender. They have done some really smart things in the transfer market. They've unearthed some gems. I think what you'll see is under Redbird, they will continue to do that. There may be some sort of more formal link with Toulouse established. That strikes me as being a partnership that could be quite intelligent. I think it is in the interest of Italian football for Redbird to make a success of AC Milan, because Italian football, as a rule, is not the most dynamic and modern league in the way it works. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, especially in terms of recruitment, in terms of coaching, in terms of data that Italian teams could use. But so often, and you can read an example of this in expected goals, so often football needs a winner for the sport to think, okay, that's okay. Football only judges things on trophies. In terms of ownership in general, it's a pattern. As you say, we know all of these names of these strange equity firms in the States. They will keep coming. And the more of them that are here, the more we'll be tempted to join in. The difference may well be kind of how well they use their equity, their investment.
I will say I have spoken to many equity groups in the past 12 months, more than I ever dreamed I would spend time talking to in my lifetime. They've suddenly woken up to the next century being football century as opposed to American sports century. They all want European ownership. The one thing they do not share is any kind of deep understanding about the machination of world football. There are some individuals who are going to be coming over to Europe in the next 24 months who know even less about football than Roger does. Rory, all I can say is your book is going to be a bestseller in many parts of the United States very soon. Milan took home a scintillating 3-2 victory in last weekend's derby della Madonnina against Inter. The mesmerising Rafael Leao recording a brace to paint Milan red. Particularly grateful to them for taking Divock Origi out of England so he cannot torture me in ways that seemed increasingly personal. Milan find themselves in Group E with Chelsea, RB Salzburg and Dinamo Zagreb. Catch up on all of those fixtures only on Paramount Plus. Next up, we're flipping the switch from Champions to Europa. That's right, listeners. It's time to Europa League it up.
This is Paramount Plus. This is original series, like Star Trek Lower Decks and Mike Judge's Beavis and Butthead.
This is going to be cool.
Live sports, like the NFL on CBS.
What a touchdown!
Family favorites, like Big Nate and Camp Coral, SpongeBob's Under Years. And exclusive movies, like Honor Society and Secret Headquarters.
Your dad's a superhero.
This is a mountain of entertainment. Paramount Plus. Stream now.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
In your ears, we're just treated to Union Berlin fans singing Mein Lebenselixier, My Life Elixir, set to the tune. I know you know this, listeners. Why do I have to tell you? It's cult Berlin pop punk group The Arzers' song, My Exploding Girlfriend. What a heck of a tune. Football bangers, they're the best bangers. And what a club Union Berlin is. Really promoted to the Bundesliga in 2019, qualifying for last year's Conference League and qualifying for the Europa League this season. I hope to take a close look at them with you soon. Oh, including the mighty unstoppable goal machine known as, amongst many aliases, PFOC. Rory, so many stories, so little time as usual. But the Europa League,
we all agree, it's where it's at. Arsenal making the trek way up north to take on Bodo Glimt.
Our boys.
And their crazy sausage concession action. But I'm curious to hear today what you make of a little team, Manchester United, under Erik ten Hag. A harrowing beginning for him in Manchester, but things seem to be settling down, courtesy of some pragmatic wins and then a signature victory this weekend against Arsenal. The playing targets have been landed, all said, just over $260 million Glazer dollars. Another high expenditure summer added to a team that had become inundated with expensive legacies of failures past. As you wrote, a patchwork of ideas and concepts and impulses rather than a cogent, coherent whole. United's issue, it's never been a failure to spend, really, rather a failure to plan. And when you look at their business this window, do you think that's changing?
Sort of. It's been a strange window for Manchester United because on one level, it's not ideal that Erik ten Hag came in and appears to have been greeted by a scouting department asking who they should go and watch. And he's been like, well, I know all these Dutch guys. What do you think? Do you want some more Dutch guys? Signed Anthony from Ajax, Lisandro Martinez from Ajax. Signed Christian Eriksen, who started his career at Ajax. Signed Malacia, who was from Feyenoord, who he tried to sign for Ajax. It's not ideal for a manager to come into a club that big and basically say, I know all of these players, we should sign all of them. But to be honest, given what Manchester United have done previously, it's probably not a bad bet. It strikes me they've probably overpaid for certainly Anthony. I'm not sure he's a $100 million player. United have handed Ajax enough money for two players to match Ajax's entire annual revenue. Suspect that's quite a good summer for Ajax as well. But ultimately, the signs are now quite promising that there seems to be a team of natural balance emerging, a team that kind of grasps some of Ten Hag's concepts. They're still playing more on the counter-attack than I think he'd like, but maybe that's a degree of necessity being the mother of invention. And to an extent, it's a bit early to say this, but you do wonder whether those two terrible results right at the start of the season have kind of given Ten Hag license to make the big calls. He's been able to drop Harry Maguire. There's suddenly not a huge amount of pressure to play Cristiano Ronaldo. It looks like the defeat at Brentford in particular was enough to convince everybody, okay, do you know what? We really do have to do something drastic and we have to start from scratch. And that's maybe what Ten Hag needed rather than trying to evolve a team that needed a revolution.
Ten Hag playing 4D chess. That 4-0 loss at Brentford, people. Possibly intentional. United's group overrunneth with Europa League goodness. Really a lovely cocktail of Cypriot club, Ammonia Nicosia. You know the club, listeners. It's where GFOP, US International of yore, Mighty Mix Disco Group plies his trade. Moldova Sheriff, who recorded a famous victory over Real Madrid with their skullduggery in last year's group stage. And hailing from beautiful, oh God, I've eaten so many incredible anchovies there. San Sebastian, Real Sociedad, who Manchester United face this week at Old Trafford, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where? Only on Paramount Plus, the return of David Silva to Manchester. Rory, before we go, just point us in the direction of one Conference League match that has alerted your journalistic spidey senses.
Well, the one that I think I'd highlight is Fiorentina against Rīgas Futbolistrola, who are a Latvian side. I think everybody's favourite Latvian side. And I just think this has got a really kind of nice Conference League feel to it. It kind of sums up what the competition it offers. You've got Fiorentina, who are a massive club, huge club, playing purple. Really important that there should be a European competition this season where a team playing in purple wins. That is my absolute agenda. For Fiorentina to win the Conference League would be a successful season for me. They're getting better, Fiorentina. They've become a reliable kind of top 6-7 team in Serie A, which is roughly where they sort of historically exist, under the slightly, how shall I put this diplomatically, up and down ownership of Rocco Cremiso, the US media magnate, but also Rīgas Futbolistrola are only the second ever Latvian team to reach the group stages of a European competition. So think how much going to the Artemio Franchi, this beautiful, brutalist stadium, will mean to them. That is the sort of thing that the Conference League does so well, that sort of matchup. Fiorentina Argentina should win relatively easily. You never know. But for Latvian football, it's really important to have that stage to play against one of the most glamorous names in European football.
Oh, just like every track needs more cowbell, European competition needs more Latvian football teams. And while we say Forza Viola, God bless you, Riga's football scholar. Thursday, 12:45 p.m. on Paramount Plus. On a level of pure amazement, I am going to be following FC Vaduz closely in this group stage. Yes, listeners, again, I'm telling you, some of you already know, Vaduz, the first club from Liechtenstein to reach any European group stage in the entire history of Liechtenstein. Country boasts only 7 clubs, which usually have to compete in the Swiss leagues, all currently in the second tier or lower. FC Vaduz, however, are the reigning champions of the Liechtenstein Football Cup, think the Florida Cup of Europe, which they've won 22 out of 23 times since 1997. There's not many teams that can beat that, and they now have been offered a route into the Conference League qualifiers, where they recorded 3 straight rounds, really of the most unlikely and joyous victories, culminating in an immense 2-1 aggregate barnstormer over Austria's Rapid Wien in front of a mighty force of 40 travelling fans. I think that's like 3/4 of the population of Liechtenstein, isn't it?
It's the entire national team.
And an entrance into the group stage. I love this story, which begins this Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern. They'll face Cypriot club FC Apollon. Don't be bullies, FC Apollon. Be live and on demand on Paramount Plus. Oh, is that a sufficient sell for the beauty of the Conference League for you, Rory Smith?
I think you're right. I think the Vaduz story is fantastic. That's what European football should be about. It's a kind of a throwback to. This is a real throwback to when Welsh teams used to get into the quarterfinals of the Cup Winners' Cup because they'd won the Welsh Cup. So you'd randomly end up with Swansea or Cardiff or Wrexham suddenly being, or even Newport County, being up against Real Madrid in the Cup Winners' Cup in 1971 or whatever. And I think it's important that those... Football is for every country. It's not just for the big countries. This is to bring us full circle. It's for Liechtenstein, that tax haven, not a great example. Liechtenstein and Latvia as much as it's for Real Madrid and for PSG.
Football's for the little countries. You sound like you're running for UEFA president, but from the beauty of the Conference League to the true beauty of this European Nights podcast, which is Rory Smith's culinary palette. Rory, Milan. If I were to helicopter in, let's just say maybe with Flight of the Valkyries blaring, or maybe something by a composer other than Wagner, where would you be taking me? Where would you be taking me to eat?
Go for Toscanini or something. I think Wagner's a bit controversial. Yeah. I would be taking you. So Navigli is the trendy bit of Milan. There's canals. There's sort of hipster bars. Obviously it's Italy, so the food's amazing wherever you go. But I quite like the kind of old time class of Brera, which is the centre of the city. It's elegant. It's sophisticated. It's got so many hotels that Fabrizio Romano can get transfer information out of. It's the perfect place to while away the hours. And I think we'll go to Convivium, which is a little restaurant that James Horncastle, an noted Italian football expert, took me out to the last time I was in Milan, which was pre-pandemic. He had the saltimbocca, which is not my kind of bag, but I had some fantastic pasta, great meat, wonderful environment. It's Milan, it's Italy, it's food. And I think from memory, there are at least 3 excellent gelato places on the walk home. So that's where we're going, Convivium.
If you like your restaurant to serve their entrees, raid in that kind of Jackson Pollock splatter of indecipherable sauces that make your palate feel very elevated. I looked up a picture on the Google and they have a wall of wine so high, you need Ibrahimovic to carry Giroud on his shoulders just to reach the top shelf. Safe to say, we will be drinking wines only within the Jordan Pickford range. That is all from us today. Rory, God bless. Thank you as ever for your insight, your Riga's football scholar, and your ability to pick apart FFP rulings like Thiago turning out of a press.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, and remember, listeners, when Rory says it's a pleasure, he says buy expected goals wherever it's available now. And remember, listeners, savor these beautiful competitions, make great memories. I know I will, alongside you. The Champions League, the Europa League and the Conference League, my favourite, are all streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. New subscribers get a 7-day free trial now by going to paramountplus.com/MIB. paramountplus.com/MIB. Courage, dear listeners, or as Serginho Dest will soon be saying, coraggio! Hey Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.